Angie has made it easier than ever to hire high-quality pros to get all your home service jobs done well. Just bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie will connect you with local pros who match your specific needs. Or book a service instantly at an upfront price. So join the millions of homeowners who use Angie to care for their homes and get your next home service job done well. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I.com. Angie has made it easier than ever to hire high-quality pros to get all your home service jobs done well. Just bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie will connect you with local pros who match your specific needs. Or book a service instantly at an upfront price. So join the millions of homeowners who use Angie to care for their homes and get your next home service job done well. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I.com.
Straight from the source tonight, from never Trumper to potential vice president. Never say never, I guess. Republican Senator J.D. Vance, now one of Donald Trump's staunchest advocates, not only trying to help him win the White House, but also in the running to join him this time. He joins us live in moments. And the former president back on the campaign trail tonight after being held in contempt for violating his gag order 9 times. He's now racing back to New York just to learn if he just violated it again. Also tonight, we are tracking the clashes and the crackdowns that are happening on college campuses across America. Hundreds of protesters have been arrested, and we'll show you new exclusive police body cam footage in moments. One of our sources tonight is former New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio on how his successor is handling it all. I'm Caitlin Collins, and this is The Source. At long last, there is music to Donald Trump's ears. Macho Man and YMCA, the hallmarks of his MAGA rallies, blaring again today as the former president returned to the campaign trail for the first time since his criminal trial began here in New York. Trump held rallies in 2 critical battleground states that he captured in 2016, but lost in 2020, Michigan and Wisconsin. Yet even out on the campaign trail, the legal cloud was still hovering over him.
As you know, I have come here today from New York City, where I'm being forced to sit for days on end in a kangaroo courtroom with a corrupt and conflicted judge enduring a Biden sideshow trial. Did I have a judge who gagged me? I'm not allowed to talk about things.
It's really just a normal courtroom. I've been inside of there as Trump was sitting at the defense table. And I should note, this is not a Biden trial. His claims about the judge being corrupt are baseless. But despite his assertion that he's not allowed to talk about this case while he is talking about this case on camera, he is allowed to say everything that you just heard there. Attacks on the judge don't fall under the gag order that Trump is under. And his return to the campaign trail was quite brief. He'll actually be back here in court tomorrow when his hush money trial resumes, and bright and early at that. Before the witness gets back on the stand tomorrow, there will be another hearing on whether Trump violated his gag order again. He was just found to be in contempt of court and fined $9,000 for violating the order 9 different times. The judge, in his finding, warned that Trump could go to jail if he continues to attack witnesses and jurors. Trump didn't comment on either today, though. He did attack President Biden and take credit for restricting abortion rights, and also he weighed in on the nationwide protests that we are seeing on college campuses.
The radical extremists and far-left agitators are terrorizing college campuses. But when you see that video of raging lunatics and Hamas sympathizers at Columbia and other colleges, no, but when you look at it, I say, where did these people come from? Where do they come from? And they do come from other countries, and they are paid.
I should note that we have not seen any evidence that protesters are being paid to be on these campuses. But while Trump was in Wisconsin today, he also addressed the question, the open one, of who he's considering to be his running mate come November.
Who's on your shortlist? Doug Burgum, Tulsi Gabbard? Who are you looking at?
I mean, all good names. We were speaking before, all good names. We have
Marco Rubio.
Marco's great. I think he's been great.
Is he one of your tops?
Well, he's one of the people I respect.
My source tonight is also a top contender to be Donald Trump's vice presidential pick, Republican Senator of Ohio, J.D. Vance. And Senator Vance, thank you for being here. You know, on just what we're seeing on college campuses, you've been very outspoken about the need for free speech on college campuses. But I wonder where you believe the line is in defending free speech and denouncing hate speech.
Yeah, Caitlin, the way that I think about it is that you have a right to free speech. People are allowed to speak, but you don't have a right to turn college campuses into garbage dumps. You don't have a right to prevent other students from going to class, and you don't have the right to commit violence. And so I think it's pretty straightforward. We're never going to strike that balance perfectly, but there's clearly, I think, an effort in this country to make sure that we have a First Amendment right to speech, and at the same time, we make sure that students can go to school without attacks. And sorry, there's sort of weird echo.
Okay, maybe it's mixed minus. We'll see if the control room can stop that, because I know how crazy it is when you can hear yourself. But on that, you know, in your home state of Ohio, I know Republicans led in passing a law protecting free speech on campuses. We saw that students at your alma mater were arrested, even though the newspaper had described it as pretty much a quite peaceful protest. And I just wonder how you see how administrators are handling what's happening there. What's happening like what we saw at Columbia last night here in New York?
Yeah, Caitlin, nobody's going to strike this balance perfectly, and I appreciate you fixing the audio issue. It is fixed. But the basic problem here is that you do have some radicals in these protests who are committing violence, who are preventing students from going to class. And certainly you don't want to arrest people who are just engaging in basic First Amendment speech, but you also want to make sure that people can go to school safely and that, you know, college campuses, which of course are public spaces, are not turned into garbage dumps by these encampments. So, I'm sure that we can find examples of college administrators being too aggressive in how they police these things. But I also think you can find some pretty good examples of students who are clearly violating the rights of other students and violating the law by engaging in some of these protests. So we've got to strike that balance. I think that so far we're doing a pretty good job in this country between letting people express their viewpoint, but not making sure, or at least I should say making sure that our Jewish students and other students are able to go to class without infringement.
Yeah.
The other thing I'll say, Caitlin, I come at this from a very pro-Israel perspective. My view on this is that Israel is our ally and that we should support them. But you can't police people for being anti-Israel or pro-Israel. You can police people for violating the law. And we have seen some of that with some of these protests.
Okay, so you agree that people who break in and vandalize a building should be prosecuted?
Exactly.
Okay, I'm just checking because you did help raise money for people who did so on January 6th, which was, you know, impeding an official proceeding, breaking into a building that they weren't allowed to be in, and vandalizing the Capitol.
Well, Caitlin, I know that this is the obsession of the national media to talk about what happened 2 years ago, 3 years ago on January the 6th.
It's not an obsession. I'm just seeing if it's a double standard.
No, let me answer the question, Caitlin. I mean, look, here's been my basic argument about January the 6th. If you beat up a cop, of course, you deserve to go to prison. If you violated the law, you should suffer the consequences. But there are people who protested on January the 6th who have had the complete weight of the Justice Department thrown at them when, at worst, they're accused of misdemeanors. Now, again, there are people who are accused of worst offenses, and that's a problem. But you can't have Black Lives Matter protesters who rioted and vandalized goes free when you have people who were actually peacefully protesting on January the 6th who have the book thrown at them. That's the double standard that I'm most worried about.
Yeah, I don't think there's an obsession with January 6th, but it is a legitimate question. And given what you just said there, and as Trump is getting closer to, you know, as he's a presumptive Republican nominee, he has said he would pardon, he's considered a blanket pardon for everyone on January 6th. Are you saying that shouldn't happen? People who beat up cops should be excluded from that?
Well, I think what President Trump has said, and of course he can speak for himself, but I pay attention, pretty close attention to what he says. And yeah, I think what the president has said is that people who have this double standard applied to them should be pardoned. And you shouldn't have the Department of Justice letting violent offenders walk scot-free. And then you have a misdemeanor trespassing case from January the 6th. That person has their life ruined because of the lawfare of the Biden administration. I think that's a totally reasonable standard for the president to apply. Hopefully he does get reelected. And I think, frankly, there are some innocent people who have been caught up in the lawfare of the Biden administration, Donald Trump included, if we're being honest.
But the ones who beat up cops, should they be excluded?
Certainly, if you assaulted a police officer, you should go to prison. And I think that's a pretty broad and agreed standard across the political spectrum. At least I hope so. I certainly think that my fellow conservatives agree.
Okay, we'll see if Trump agrees with that. You know, but back to what's happening on these campuses, as this has been such a national story. Trump, when he was in New York, compared it to what happened in Charlottesville in 2017. Obviously, when neo-Nazis were chanting, "Jews will not replace us," 3 people were killed, 35 were injured. Trump said that was a little peanut compared to what we're seeing right now. Is that an accurate equivalency in your view?
Well, look, I think that what you've seen is nationwide anti-Semitic protests, a number of students who have been assaulted, a number of people who have prevented from exercising their constitutional rights. And you know, I think Trump, as he often does, highlights the really ridiculous double standards that sometimes exist in this country. When you had what was coded as a conservative protest that had a lot of anti-Semites, the entire national media was preoccupied with it, obsessed with it, I would say. When you have a series of very often anti-Semitic protests all across college campuses, a number of acts of vandalism, somehow all of a sudden the media doesn't care about it. I think it's reasonable for the president to draw attention to that, and I agree with him.
But what was happening in Charlottesville was one of the largest gatherings of white nationalists in a decade. Obviously, what's happening on these campuses, we've seen how it's gotten out of control. But ostensibly, they're there protesting the war in Gaza. I'm curious why there's a need to compare the two, and if you see it that way.
Well, I don't necessarily think there's a need to compare. In fact, I'd say that President Trump is one of the few people who's actually condemned both sides. In other words, he condemned the protest in Charlottesville to the extent that it got violent. He also noted, honestly, that there were peaceful protesters in Charlottesville, too. He's also condemned the protests that have broken out across our college campuses. So again, I think that if you actually look at what President Trump has said, he's making a reasonable observation that there's a ridiculous media double standard. But he has, I think, the courage to condemn acts of anti-Semitism, whether they're coming from the perceived right or the perceived left.
I would disagree that it's a media double standard. But you're a Yale-educated attorney, and I want to get your take on what we saw happen last week, those immunity arguments before the Supreme Court, where Trump's team, his attorney, argued that a president could order the military to stage a coup and to have their political opponent assassinated and be immune from prosecution unless this theory that they were impeached and then convicted by the Senate. Do you share the view that presidents are basically above the law?
Look, Caitlin, I think we have to be careful about imputing words into the president's attorneys that they didn't actually say. What the president's attorney said is that what the president's attorney said, Caitlin, to be clear, is that there is a checks and balances system in our Constitution. Now, some things the president does, private acts, are liable to criminal penalties. But most of the things that the president does in their official duties, we have a system of impeachment. We have a system of checks and balances, the legislative branch that I'm a member of, the judicial branch. I did not read the president's attorneys as saying that the president could order a coup. The president's attorneys are saying that the constitutional checks and balances system would address that problem. And I think that's an important distinction.
But let me stop you right there, because I listened to this. It's John Sauer, Trump's attorney. And when he was asked by one of the justices if the president could order the military to stage a coup and would it count as an official act, meaning he couldn't be prosecuted for it, he said it would depend on the circumstances. I mean, what circumstances warrant a president ordering the military to stage a coup?
Well, first of all, he did say it depends on the circumstances, so that it opens up a whole lot of avenue for context there. But more importantly, Caitlin, he's just saying that would count as an official act.
But could I finish the
answer to the question, Caitlin? An official act, there are a number of checks and balances in our system. There's the impeachment process. There's the budgeting authority that Congress has. There are a number of ways where Congress has a check and balance control over the President of the United States. All he's saying is that the criminal liability procedures that exist in this country don't cover the president's official acts. And by the way, how could anybody disagree with that, Caitlin? Should Barack Obama be prosecuted for killing an American citizen via a drone strike? There are a number of examples in American history where if you apply the standard, the lawfare standard of the Biden administration against Donald Trump, it would make the presidency impossible to actually execute the law. In the name of taking down their political opponent, Caitlin, these guys are really pushing a legal theory that I think would destroy the presidency, whether a Democrat or Republican was in charge.
Well, I don't think Jack Smith is running for office. But on what you're saying, you're basically saying that if the president orders the military to stage a coup. You believe the only remediation for that is that he can be impeached or that Congress can restrict the budget?
Well, Caitlin, first of all, you're dealing with hypotheticals here that are completely outside the bounds of this particular situation. Donald Trump did not order a coup, despite the fact that a lot of media people say that he did on January the 6th. He encouraged people to protest peacefully. And of course, most people on January 6th did protest peacefully. What I'm saying is that you have to have some measure of liability for the official acts of presidency of the United States. And the way to create a check and balance on that system is what the Constitution prescribes here. You can't have prosecutors, many of whom, of course, are deeply embedded with the Democratic Party, trying to destroy the life of a former president who's now running for president because they think that they have a better argument for what that president should have done. You can have a political disagreement with Donald Trump, and that's totally reasonable. You shouldn't destroy the presidency in the process. Okay. And I think that's what a lot of the Biden administration Department of Justice is trying
to do. But you essentially are agreeing that the presidents should not be able to be prosecuted. Let me ask you something else, because as I mentioned, there is an open question of who Donald Trump will pick to be his vice presidential candidate. We just heard him talking about Marco Rubio. You're hosting a fundraiser with him in your home state of Ohio later this month. I know you say that you two haven't discussed the vice presidency directly, but you said you'd certainly be open to it if he did offer it to you. Considering that, does it give you any pause whatsoever about taking that job when you see how he treated his last vice president?
Well, Caitlin, first of all, again, I haven't talked to Donald Trump about becoming vice president. I think it's important to support President Trump as Republicans because I think he was a good president. And I think that he made the country more prosperous. And I think he made the world more peaceful. What gives me pause, Caitlin, is another 4 years of Biden's administration where he's opened the borders and where you have effectively a conflict, a major world conflict in nearly every continent in the world.
But my question was not about President Biden. It's about President Trump.
Well, look, it's fundamentally about President Biden, because if you're comparing the two records of these presidents and asking, who do I want to be president? It's very clearly that I want Donald Trump to be president. And I understand that there are a lot of things that people like you disagree that he did. But I think fundamentally, he was a good president. He accomplished a lot for the country. And the question fundamentally for our country is, do we want 4 more years of Joe Biden, or do we want 4 more years of the peace and prosperity of Donald Trump? That, to me, is an easy question.
The last time I checked, President Biden wasn't approving of the chance to hang his vice president and did not call his vice president when their life was in danger on Capitol Hill, something that Mike Pence himself has testified to. So my question is, does it give you any pause to be his vice president, given how he has treated Mike Pence?
Caitlin, I'm extremely skeptical that Mike Pence's life was ever in danger. I think politics and politics people like to really exaggerate things from time to time.
I know Mike a lot of Pence folks in the Democratic Party.
A lot of folks in the Democratic Party, Caitlin, act as if January the 6th was the scariest moment of their lives. I think, look, January 6th was a bad day. It was a riot. But the idea that Donald Trump endangered anyone's lives when he told them to protest peacefully, it's just absurd. And the entire legal basis of this prosecution of Donald Trump from Jack Smith.
But they were chanting that they wanted to hang him.
Look, Caitlin, did a few people say some bad things? Sure, but do we blame Donald Trump for every bad thing that's ever been said by a participant in American democracy? I think that's an absurd standard. And look, Caitlin, I know you're worried, and I think justifiably so, about
threats
to American—
This isn't about me, Senator. I'm asking questions about you and how you would feel about this.
Look, I'm trying to answer the question. I appreciate if you let me. We know that there are threats to American democracy. I think the biggest threat to American democracy, Caitlin, is that the Biden administration is trying to prevent Donald Trump from campaigning and taking his case to the American people,
they hide their own candidate. That's presiding over that case. The Biden administration is not preventing Donald Trump from campaigning. He just did two campaign events tonight.
This is a really important point, Caitlin. Who is the number three person from the Biden Department of Justice who went to work for the New York prosecutor just months before he brought this case against Donald Trump? You can't have people moving from the Biden administration to prosecute Donald Trump in New York and say it has nothing to do with the Biden administration, especially
when the
judge is
the
Biden administration donor.
Attorneys go from the Justice Department to local DA's offices all the time. That's not that unusual. I mean, you're
it's
an attorney. You know
it's,
that.
It's pretty
unusual.
You probably
have colleagues who went to Yale with you that did that.
It's pretty unusual for the number three person in the Department of Justice to then go to the New York prosecutor's office to bring a bogus case against Donald Trump, and then to have the judge presiding over that case to be a donor to Biden-Harris. I think that's pretty unusual, Caitlin, and really is, aside from your views or anyone else's views about Donald Trump, this is a real threat to Americans' trust in the legal system. If you look at polling, even a lot of folks who are going to vote for Joe Biden think that the lawfare against Donald Trump is bogus. We're destroying faith in the American system of law and order to try to bring down Joe Biden's political opponent. That's a threat to democracy.
It's a jury of his peers that indicted him and a jury of his peers that will be that are in that room right now and will decide this case. Senator J.D. Vance, thank you for joining us here on The Source.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, Maggie Haberman is here to talk about that interview. Also, the view from Trump World about his ongoing trial as he's set to return tomorrow. Also, amid the ongoing chaos that is happening on college campuses, we're learning more tonight about the influence, the potential involvement of outside agitators in this, and questions over what we are hearing from the New York City mayor on that.
Angie has made it easier than ever to hire high-quality pros to get all your home service jobs done well. Whether it's routine maintenance, an emergency repair, or a dream project, Angie lets you compare quotes from multiple local pros, browse homeowner reviews, and even book a service instantly. Angie's been connecting people with skilled pros for nearly 30 years. So the next time you have a home project, bring it to Angie to get your job done well. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
Moments ago, you just heard from Republican Senator and potential Trump running mate J.D. Vance on everything that is going on, and including with that potential question of who Trump is going to pick. I asked him what he thought about this idea. We've heard from J.D. Vance on what he would have done if he was vice president on January 6th. He wouldn't have done what Mike Pence did. He's made that clear. But also a question was what he thinks about how Donald Trump has treated his former vice president. The last time I checked, President Biden wasn't approving of the chance to hang his vice president and did not call his vice president when their life was in danger on Capitol Hill, something that Mike Pence himself has testified to. So my question is, does it give you any pause to be his vice president, given how he has treated Mike Pence?
Caitlin, I'm extremely skeptical that Mike Pence's life was ever in danger. I think politics and politics people like to really exaggerate things from time to time.
I know Mike a lot Pence of folks in the Democratic Party. That, Senator. My source tonight to react to that, New York Times senior political correspondent and CNN political analyst Maggie Haberman, now Trump court watcher, as we were in the courtroom yesterday. On J.D. Vance, he is someone who is, there are a lot of names always swirling around for Trump's potential vice president. But J.D. Vance is usually on the top of the list, when you talk to these people in Trump's orbit.
100%. There's a lot of people who think that ultimately it will be Vance. Now, to be clear, we have no idea what Trump is going to do, and it's a real fool's errand to try to predict who he's going to choose for anything. But Vance is very clearly a top choice, and part of it is because of what we just saw in that interview. He is really effective in defending Trump on television. Now, I think the Secret Service would also disagree that Mike Pence's life was not in danger, but that's a separate issue. Vance is communicating the message that Trump wants, both on the legal cases and against the media. And so there are a lot of reasons, including Trump's own personal comfort and chemistry. You know this as well as anybody. For Trump, so much of what he does with personnel comes down to chemistry and interpersonal relationships, and he really likes Vance.
He also brought up Matthew Colangelo there at the end. Mm-hmm. That is one of the prosecutors on the Manhattan District Attorney's team. When Trump was going after him, that was found to be a violation of the gag order. Mm-hmm. And the gag order was expanded, I should say, to include the people on Alvin Bragg's team, not Alvin Bragg, because there was a concern about them being put at risk, for implications like that. Trump's got another gag order hearing tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I wonder what you're making of how he's reacting to being fined $9,000, not a huge fee for him, but being told by the judge, if you keep doing this, jail is a real possibility.
There are some people around him who think that he is intentionally trying to see how far he can go and that he thinks that being jailed will help him, even if it's for a day. Most people I talk to who know Trump pretty well do not think that he actually really wants to go to jail. I don't think he wants to sit in that courtroom every day. Do people think that jail is going to be a more pleasant experience for him? But I do think that we see him often go up and touch the hot stove, and then he comes back a little bit, and sometimes he goes up again. He is always testing the bounds of what he can get away with. Now, he did take down the social media posts that he was ordered to take down yesterday. He did not, as you note, attack witnesses or people connected to the case, relatives of the court, et cetera, at his rallies today. But we'll see what happens going forward.
Yeah, Trump doesn't even like to stay in hotel rooms. I remember on foreign trips when he was president, he didn't even like staying in other hotel rooms. But on the courtroom itself, you and I were both in there. You were in the row in front of me yesterday watching. It's really fascinating to be inside that courtroom and to see it. You know, there's no cameras, but to actually see it with your own eyes and to watch Trump's demeanor as people like Keith Davidson are testifying about negotiating hush money payments on Stormy Daniels' behalf with him.
Yesterday was very tense in that courtroom, and there have been some days that have been tense. Some days have been pretty lax. Yesterday was very tense for a couple of reasons. The testimony that you're talking about, you know, you had Keith Davidson, the lawyer for Stormy Daniels, during that time period of October 2016, just reading to validate these text exchanges with Michael Cohen or with Dylan Howard, the AMI executive who he was working with. And they were really, really damaging about Trump, with his middle son sitting behind him in the courtroom and a phalanx of aides. The Texas Attorney General, Ken Paxton, was there. David McIntosh from the Club for Growth was there. This was unusual to watch. And Trump deals with it. Sometimes he is sleeping. I know there's this huge sleeping debate, but
yes, the great debate of our time.
Right. It's the most important thing of the trial, and I mean that in no way. But sometimes he is. Sometimes he is sleeping. That is 100% true. I've seen it. People around him have confirmed to me that he has been sleeping at times that we have said he is. However, sometimes he is closing his eyes, and I've talked to people around him about this too, because that is how he tries to just basically stay calm and deal with it. And whether that then leads to sleep or whatever, who knows? But he is sitting there with his eyes closed for long periods of time. It's not always sleeping.
Yeah, I noticed this because he's very clearly awake, but his eyes are closed for like a minute at a time.
Sometimes more.
As Keith Davidson or the witness is answering, it's like he doesn't want to hear what they're saying.
I think it is a compartmentalization method, and he's pretty good at compartmentalizing.
And I know you'll be back in the courtroom tomorrow. Maggie Haberman, great reporting as always. Thank you. Up next, we have new exclusive video here tonight on CNN of the arrest of protesters at Columbia University. This is from the body cams of the police officers as they were going into the building to arrest them. New York City's former mayor Bill de Blasio is here to weigh in his take on how his successor has been handling the unrest. Tonight, you are seeing right now exclusive video to CNN from NYPD body cams that show the moments and take you inside last night as police retook Columbia University's Hamilton Hall from the pro-Palestinian protesters inside. The crackdown that you are seeing here, where hundreds of protesters were arrested, is exactly why New York City Mayor Eric Adams has come under scrutiny. He has been defending the city's response, including on CNN here tonight.
We need to be clear on this. I received a letter from the school, and in the letter from the school that asked us to come in, they said it was a clear and present danger and that they had outside individuals who were on the grounds participating in this activity. So it was not only our observation from our intelligence division, but it was also the school officials who asked us to step in.
Mayor Adams is saying that many of the 280 protesters arrested last night were outside agitators, which students at Columbia are pushing back on.
When NYPD came in, they pushed all press away from where we were so they couldn't document anything. And then they ambushed us, they tackled us, they beat us. And I want to also highlight that majority of the protesters there last night were young women. We're young college women from marginalized communities.
I should note, CNN has not been given a breakdown of how many outsiders they say were arrested at Columbia last night. We are getting numbers from New York University. School officials there say less than half of those arrested at protests on campus last week were students and staff members. We are still trying to figure out the numbers from last night. Joining me now here to discuss is former New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio. And Mayor, obviously, you know exactly the role and the position that Eric Adams is now in. What do you make of how he's been handling this? Is it how you would handle it?
Yeah, I think he did the right thing. Look, you can't have protests turn into violence. You just can't allow it to happen. I respect protesters, peaceful protesters, who are saying they want a change in U.S. policy, for example. That's legitimate freedom of speech. But when you start taking over buildings, destroying property, creating an atmosphere that bluntly is threatening to a lot of other fellow students and extremely disruptive, that's the point where something has to be done.
Yeah, but I think there's a question about his claim about the outside agitators. And the only reason, you know, it's been questioned and raised is because before they went in, you know, this is kind of what he had said was the rationale for going in. Some of the people, though, that he's saying were there say they weren't there in recent days. At least two of the women. One of them says she wasn't there. Another says, you know, she was a 63-year-old that was, you know, on campus. And she's someone who is known to go to a lot of protests and is an activist. I mean, if you're in leadership, when you say things like that, it matters.
Yes, of course. But Caitlin, there has been a trend in recent years to a small group of protesters who are willing to use violence. We saw this in the 2020 protests. We saw it all over the country. I was talking to mayors all over the country in that very, very tense moment. Vast majority of people were peacefully protesting. But there was a subset that were willing to use violence.
Yeah, we saw the riots. I mean, we just heard Senator J.D. Vance talking about that.
And unfortunately, you could have 5 people, 10 people, 20 people who poison the well for everyone else. But the minute you introduce violence, it's incumbent upon leaders to step in and bring back peace and order to the situation. And by the way, I would say to protesters, I've been a protester myself over the years, if you let folks who are going to commit violence into your ranks, you actually undermine your own cause. So I respect the students who are lifting their voices and acting nonviolently, but they actually have responsibility, too, to make sure that everyone in their movement comports themselves peacefully.
You know, it's been fascinating to watch how your party has been handling this. Different Democrats, obviously not a monolith, handling this differently. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar was asked about these protests in recent days when she was on Capitol Hill. And I just want you to hear what she said about Jewish students on college campuses in a comment from this weekend.
I think it is really unfortunate that people don't care about the fact that all Jewish kids should be kept safe and that we should not have to tolerate anti-Semitism or bigotry for all Jewish students, whether they are pro-genocide or anti-genocide.
Look, pro-genocide or anti-genocide?
I mean, it's a horrible terminology, and I've disagreed with the Congress member before. I disagree with her using those words. But I will say there are a lot of students who feel afraid. I know plenty of Jewish students around this country feel afraid right now, and they've been exposed to clearly anti-Semitic language. That's not everyone who's protesting. Again, I believe most people who are protesting are trying to raise legitimate concerns about what's happening in the region and calling for peace. I want peace, too. I want this war to end. But we have to be clear. There's language being used, and I think some of it's on each side. We saw what happened in UCLA as well. The minute you use threatening language, the minute you use exclusionary language, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, that's not progressive, that's not democratic, that should not be allowed. And I think college campuses have a right to crack down on that kind of situation because it creates an atmosphere of threat. Remember, these universities have responsibility to keep their kids safe and ensure that they feel safe, that they can go about their education not expecting to be confronted in a way that could be physically threatening. And so right now, I would say as a Democrat, as a progressive, we need to come to grips with this. We need to be very blunt. Democrats should embrace that we do not allow any violence, any anti-Semitism, any Islamophobia. And I think if we don't do that, the Republicans are going to weaponize this issue for the fall election. So I would further say, if you care about this country, from my perspective, you care about Joe Biden being elected, then let's stop fooling around here. We have to condemn any kind of violence, any kind of exclusion. You can't have any tolerance for anti-Semitism, for example. It will poison the well politically and morally.
Former New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, thank you for joining us here on set tonight. Up next, you know, speaking of how Republicans are using this, you've seen Donald Trump blaming them on President Biden, who has also been pretty quiet about this issue. The question is, what does it mean for November? We'll talk about it with our experts right after this.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. Join me, Philip Nguyen, a scholar of Vietnamese-American culture, and the cast and crew as we discuss the making of this historic series. Subscribe now to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts and stream HBO's The Sympathizer starting April 14th exclusively on Max.
The former president has made clear in his public comments that he sees these images of police arresting college students by the dozens amid these nationwide protests as good for him politically.
They went into one of the big buildings, a beautiful landmark building. Boy, they got the hell beat out of it last night. It was a beautiful thing to watch. New York's finest.
Those comments fit a pattern that we have seen from Donald Trump. We've heard from his own former defense secretary, Mark Esper, who wrote in his book, A Sacred Oath, about Trump asking, "Can't you just shoot them?" about George Floyd demonstrators. The way Trump talks about protest has harkened back to a racist history that we have seen in this country of a police brutality, including when Trump once tweeted, "When the looting starts, the shooting starts." Even when the protest was peaceful on the sidelines of a football game, Trump wanted those NFL players removed.
Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, "Get that son of a bitch off the field right now."
Meanwhile, the person in the Oval Office right now, President Biden, has said quite little about the unrest that we are seeing on campuses. The White House today tried to answer questions about his relative silence by saying no president has been more forceful about combating anti-Semitism than he has. Here to talk about all this tonight, Cornell William Brooks, the former president and CEO of the NAACP and a Harvard professor, and David Frum, a staff writer for The Atlantic and a former speechwriter for President George W. Bush. And David, let me start with you because, you know, Biden has been quite silent about this. I mean, there was that one moment on Earth Day where he was asked and he kind of had this statement that even some Democrats believed was a bit ambivalent. And I just wonder, is this a moment for the president to be speaking out more, in your view?
Well, let's bracket something. You set this up by introducing remarks from former President Donald Trump, who incited the worst violent attack on the authority of the U.S. federal government, the worst domestic violent attack on the authority of the U.S. government since the Civil War. So he doesn't have any standing here. But the issue for President Biden is one of whether he is going to seem firm or weak. There are two great questions that haunt each of the two parties. The great question about any Republican leader is, are you uncaring? And Republicans have to constantly reassure people that they can have humanity, that they care, that they have respect, that they have an understanding of the equality of all Americans. The great question, fairly or unfairly over Democrats, is always, are they too weak to stand up against the forces of disorder in society? So President Biden doesn't have an anti-Semitism, probably, exactly. Because everyone understands that he stood with Israel. He stands with the Jewish people. He's got a long record of that. The question is, will he enforce authority, both against the kind of violent rioters who attack the Capitol, both and against the violent rioters who are attacking campuses? Not that those are equally important, because obviously attacking the government is worse than attacking a campus, but they are the same psychology, and he has to stand for law in all cases against all challengers to law.
Cornell, I wonder how you see that and what the president's role in speaking out on this is.
I would very much agree with David that President Biden has a long history of standing with the Jewish community, standing with Israel, and standing against anti-Semitism. Where I might differ is that President Biden is looking across the landscape of America, and he's probably taking note of the fact that there are many protests, many demonstrations, overwhelmingly non-violent, and he's looking at college campuses where there are people who have engaged in violence, who have taken over buildings, where law enforcement has had to respond, but there are moments where you can question how they're responding, when they should respond, what else can we do to prevent these kinds of eruptions of violence? And he's looking across the country, and I suspect that he would much rather not make a bumper sticker response, but rather respond thoughtfully, carefully, in a way that's tailored to the place we find ourselves as a country. And so I'm not sure if it's silence or is it being thoughtful. as opposed to what we've heard from the former president.
David, I wonder, you know, one thing we've also heard, and that's a really good point, Cornell, about the comparison here, but I wonder, you know, we also are hearing comparisons to 1968, and I wonder how you view that, David.
I think it's nonsense. Look, many of the rioters have seen YouTube videos of 1968 and think they know the history, but the police have actually learned from the history. And this is one of the reasons I wrote for The Atlantic, why I think they're that the small cadre of really violent people who imagine disrupting the Democratic convention are kidding themselves. The 1968 convention, security was provided by an unprofessional, overly emotional, bigoted Chicago police force under local control. Modern conventions are national security special events. Security is provided by the Secret Service. So the federal government provides about $50 million to each convention for security. It's directed at both conventions by the Secret Service. They can call on not only the resources of that particular city, but the whole state, and indeed the resources of the federal government, including the Department of Defense and the Coast Guard if the city's on the water. I was at the 2004 Republican convention at the peak of anti-Iraq war mobilization, a much bigger protest movement than this on campus, with much wider social support. There were 1,800 arrests in 2004. It did not disrupt the Republican convention that year because the police were able to enforce perimeters. And with all of these demonstrations, the key to lawful, peaceful protest is for the police to be clear, here's where the boundary is. If you're on this side of the fence, and if you follow certain rules, don't attack people, you can speak. If you cross the perimeter, we arrest you.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big question. And Cornell, also, I mean, just, you know, seeing this going forward, you know, final word from you on that.
Sure. Let's take note of this. The past is a lesson book. It is not a mirror. So when we look at 1968, we look at Columbia, we look at Cornell in 1969, Jackson State, and Kent State University in 1970. The lessons are that when the police come in, when the National Guard comes in, we can't always predict what will happen. Students may be killed, students may be hurt, bystanders may be hurt. So the lessons of the past is we need to be thoughtful, we need to be careful. But the past is not a mirror. The student protests and demonstrations of today are not nearly as large as they were a generation ago or even 2 years ago. So this is a moment where, out of concern and caution for Jewish students, but students more generally, all have a role to play. It's not merely a matter of when we call in the police and what they do. This is also what college administrators do up until the point of a crisis.
It's a great question.
And presidential candidates and all of us as commentators. So in other words, let's think about it this way. We have to think about students as not merely demonstrators today, but as citizens of tomorrow. And let's stand by them and help them improve this democracy.
Yeah, it's a great question. We'll see what it looks like going forward. Cornell William Brooks, David Frum, thank you both. As one of the most restrictive abortion laws in the nation is going into effect today in Florida, Vice President Kamala Harris was there blaming former President Donald Trump. You'll want to hear her comments right after a quick break. Lawmakers in Arizona voted tonight to throw out a near total abortion ban from the Civil War era in that key battleground state, just 3 weeks after we saw the Supreme Court there in that state revive it. Today, also in Florida, one of the most restrictive abortion laws in the nation went into effect. Vice President Harris was in Jacksonville today, and she blamed one person by name for it all.
Across our nation, we witness a full-on assault, state by state, on reproductive freedom. And understand who is to blame. Former President Donald Trump did this.
And Ashley Allison and Margaret Hoover are both here with me. And Ashley, I just wonder what you thought of how the administration has been using Vice President Harris and deploying her very specifically to Florida the day this ban went into effect.
I think it's important.
This 6-week law, let me be clear.
Yes. Which
I will.
I just
say
don't want Ron DeSantis tweeting me. I want to make sure I have it right.
I will say, use that word, that it is basically a ban at 6 weeks, because most women don't even know they're pregnant at that point. I think it's important that the vice president continues to go not just to battleground states, but even to states that are traditionally more conservative, like a Kansas or a Montana, where those restrictions are going into effect as well. And voters are standing up and saying, that's not the way we want our government to be in our doctors and making decisions about our life. So this is not just a battleground issue state. This is a state that is affecting women and families across the country. And so it's really important that the vice president's voice and the president's voice are being used in the campaign, but also in the administration to protect reproductive justice and freedom.
Yeah, especially Florida, because all the neighboring states also have similar restrictive laws. In Arizona, though, when they're voting to repeal that Civil War era near ban, only two Republicans broke with their party and voted with Democrats to do so.
And it was the same very, very small vote in the House of Representatives even the week before in the State House that did it. I think it were three Republicans in the State House. Of course, they only have a one-vote majority in both of those houses. So it's enormously close, and I think that's the answer, is the stakes were so high for Republicans and for Arizona. I think the Trump team breathes a sigh of relief tonight, actually, because this was catalyzing and going to catalyze so much mobilization of new voters in Arizona. It probably still will, because abortion will probably still be a ballot amendment in Arizona, but it won't probably have the thrust of energy that it would have had if there had been a near total ban on abortion, except for the life of the mother come November.
Well, it's also kind of created a rift among Republicans of, you know, are we in support of this, or do we want it to stay in?
Yeah. I just think, I know that they did this act, but for the next 90 days, women still won't have access to reproductive justice. But the important thing is that they're doing it right now for politics, because they don't want to lose the election. What happens after the election? That's what voters need to pay attention to and keep that energy around for November.
We'll see what it looks like. Of course, the administration taking full advantage of it. Ashley Allison, Margaret Hoover, great to have you both here on set tonight. Thank you all so much for joining us tonight. We'll see you back here tomorrow. CNN Newsnight with Abby Phillip starts right now.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, host of the Chasing Life podcast. In honor of our 10th season, we want to hear from you. Leave us a message at 470-396-0832 and tell us how you chase life. It could be used on an upcoming episode.